Hello, and welcome to the Anchor Podcast, a ministry of Rock Harbor Church. We want to help guide and grow you in your walk with the Lord by providing an in-depth study of God's Word. So please grab your Bibles and let's set a course for spiritual maturity. Here's Pastor Brandon with this week's message.
So we're on the doctrine of rewards, and I wanted to talk about the continuance of part two of the incorruptible crown that you get if you master the sin nature. And just to refresh our minds, it's called the incorruptible crown or imperishable crown. And just to let's just look at it again, and I'm going to take off on part two once we refresh our minds. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And again, we're not talking about salvation. We're talking about a reward of an imperishable crown given to those who master the sin nature. So like we talked about, you have to run according to the rules. I talked about that, about how many rules are there? There's about 1,050 rules. It's almost double that of the Mosaic law. So when you hear Christians say, we're not under the law, well, that's true in one sense. We're not under the Mosaic law, but you're under the law of the Messiah. So I don't know how you're going to get around that one. But again, law never saves anybody. There's law in the Old Testament. It's before the Mosaic period. The law of the patriarchs, the law of Eden, the law, the Noahic law, all those things. So law always exists. There's law in the Messianic kingdom. Law always exists. It's just law never saves you. So competing according to the rules means I'm going to keep the law of the Messiah. Not that we keep it perfectly, but you're striving to keep it, because if you are disqualified, it's because you're not running according to the rules or according to the law of the Messiah, which means you're out of fellowship and you're disqualified. So anyway, we talked about that. And we talked about this whole thing is a reference to the Isthmian Games that was close to Corinth. So it's kind of like the Olympiad. So he's talking, he's using competing terminology. Everyone who competes or fights or struggles or contends for the prize is temperate. And temperate, obviously self-controlled, self-governed, abstain from things preparing when you're preparing for a competition. Is that me? I'm sorry. I thought that was static. Sorry. So the concept of self-control is the theme in this. And that's where we want to capitalize on it, because then, he says, they do it to obtain an imperishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty, thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, not shadow back boxing. He said, basically, his idea is that I have an intended target for the punch, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest I, when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. So a lot of people throughout church history has misunderstood what the Apostle Paul is talking about. It is obvious in the context he's using metaphors, right? He's using metaphors for like boxing, running, disciplining his body, making his body a slave to him. And so what other people have done, especially in the Catholic tradition, and or even probably Orthodox as well, is they take this literally, and they will practice like self-flagellation, where they take like a cat of nine tails and whip themselves on the back and like torture themselves and sleep on, the ground. And it has led to asceticism. Asceticism is dead wrong, by the way. So you'll have these desert fathers practicing asceticism. They pull out of society. They go live in the desert. They live in caves. And they think that is what Paul is talking about, of disciplining your body or actually self-mutilating your body. I mean, there's literally guys in church history that gouged out their eyes or cut off their hands or something like that, taking this to the extreme literalness. And that's obviously not what Paul's talking about. So that's a misunderstanding that I could hurt my body, and by hurting my body, it can corral the sin nature. It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. And when he's talking about the body, he's talking about, well, that's the instrument. It's a secondary issue, because that's the instrument, the hands, the body, whatever, the feet, the legs, whatever. That's the instrument in which the sin nature uses. And it's the instruments in which the sin nature is connected. So yeah, it's a reference kind of to the body since that's the instrument, but that's not what's controlling the body. There's a glove in the hand, or sorry, a hand in the glove, so to speak, that's controlling the body, which is the sin nature. And that's what he's trying to get. He goes, so the object then is, he's using this competition of saying, this is how you master the sin nature. Okay, so let me go back here real quick. Where's the text at? I'm looking for that text. Here we go. Okay, so here the word temperate, okay? Again, that's what he's referring to as to the sin nature, that I am going to struggle or contend and strive with this sin nature. That's what I'm going to control, not the body per se. That will happen in the secondary aspect. Okay, so to understand him better, then you have to understand the illustration then he gives to understand, well, then how do I master the sin nature? Because it's not just simply a matter of I'm going to try really hard to master it. That's not possible under your power. So he talks about what happened to Israel. He says, moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware or ignorant that all our fathers were under the cloud. It's talking to the Exodus generation that were under the cloud, the Shekinah cloud that protected them in the desert, right? So that's a reference to the Exodus generation. All passed through the sea. That's them going through the Red Sea, obviously. That was their baptism. He mentions this. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. So that's their spiritual baptism, so to speak. So he's using that as a typology. So Paul is using the Exodus as a typology for salvation, okay? All ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink. So they were fed by manna, they were fed by God by through the water and the rock. And so the analogy or the typology is pointing from is that this generation is a generation that had access to all the spiritual benefits and blessings that God afforded them. Now, are some of them unsaved? Yeah, possibly. But that's not what Paul's driving at. He's not even concerning himself whether they're saved or not. He is saying, look, they all participated in this. So in effect, the whole nation is guilty if the whole nation goes a certain way. And so he's trying to relate it to the individual Corinth church and saying, look, the same thing that happened to them is going to happen to you. You guys are all, I'm not saying any of you are not saved. I'm saying you're all going to make the same mistake. You all came to faith. You all were redeemed. You were all baptized, just like Israel was, right? And you drank of the same spiritual nourishment that I gave you guys, just as they drank from Moses and the rock and were fed by manna. You were fed spiritually too. So he's equating Corinth with this generation, okay? For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So obviously the rock is a typology for Christ, striking the rock twice. Obviously Moses did wrong. Again, kind of messed up the typology for Christ being struck only once, right? But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now, again, if you notice verse 5, he is not saying that the reason they died was because they were unbelievers. That's not what he's arguing, because he's going to tell the Corinth church, the reason some of you have died is because you took the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner. So again, we're not talking about salvation. He's sticking on the subject of what can happen to a believer if you become disqualified, and how you become disqualified by not getting your sin nature under control. Now these things become our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Okay, well, most of Moses' problems in the desert was because the Israelites kept desiring something that was off limits to them. that God had said no. And so the issue that he's trying to say is, look, they had evil desires that they couldn't control, and that's what got them, a lot of them, dead, whether it's Korah's rebellion, whether that was the golden calf, whether that was Baal Peor, in which the many of them worshiped and committed sexual immorality with them, with the other people other than the Israelites. And so a lot of people died in the desert, and then a lot of them died because they didn't go into the promised land. So he goes, look, the end result of what of them not controlling the sin nature is that they physically died. That's his point. That's the writer of Hebrews' point, okay? So then he goes on and says, and do not become idolaters as some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. That's a reference to the golden calf, right? They sat down and played. And the idea of play is sexual play. They started having an orgy around the golden calf. Nor let us commit sexual immorality, because that's the end result of idolatry, as some of them did. As in one day, 23,000 fell. That's when they started worshiping Baal Peor. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted. So they tempted God, and we too, as believers, can tempt Christ, and were destroyed by serpents. So you had a situation where many of them died because they were bit by serpents. And again, he's not talking about salvation. He's talking about the punishment for doing what they did. Okay. And then, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. So that you're talking about the death angel. And so a lot of them kept grumbling and moaning to Moses. So God killed some of them that kept grumbling and murmuring to Moses. Then he goes, now all of these things happened to them as examples. And they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. And that last statement is saying, hey, look, this is an example for us, upon whom the end of the ages have come, which is the Messiah. And he's saying, don't think that you're not going to be held to a greater standard than what they were held to, or a lesser standard, because you're going to be held to a greater standard than what they were, because you have the Messiah. You know him. They had a shadowy image of him. You know a lot more. So to whom much is given, much is required. Okay. So the key in all of this, if you read the text, there's your answer of how to control the sin nature. That's it. Do not become idolaters as some of them. Now, on prima facie, when you look at that, I'm like, okay, I don't become an idolater. Okay, I'm not worshiping a stone or a piece of wood or whatever that I've fashioned into a god. But yeah, but it's a lot more deeper than that. And so if you're going to corral the sin nature, you have to corral idolatry in your life. That's the answer. Okay? So the golden calf is the prime example of this. And what you have to do is you have to really take a step back and really understand from not only a spiritual standpoint, but a mental standpoint, a psychological standpoint, why anyone would do this. Why would they create a golden calf? Because it seems absurd, but they did. And it got them in big trouble, and many of them died because of it. And the continuance of Israel's idolatry gets them killed constantly. It shortens their life, shortens what they're doing. And the same is true that Paul is saying. He's saying, look, if you're going to get the incorruptible crown, you got to corral the sin nature. But then you have to corral the sin nature, you have to corral the idolatry in you. So what is it? Well, to understand the sin nature, you have to understand that the sin nature wants to produce worship, okay? But it's perverted. So deep down inside of you, in your soul, you have eternity in you, as Ecclesiastes says. And that eternity wants to worship. It wants to sacrifice. But because you have a sin nature, that desire for worship and sacrifice is perverted. It inverts everything. So God says, worship me. Your sin nature says, I will not worship you. That's how you have to think about yourself inside of you. The demon inside of you is telling you, I don't want to do it. I want to do something different. And the sin nature, this hellish, hellish form of you that's inside of you wants to create a counterfeit system. Okay? The counterfeit system is I want to fashion a God in the image in which I want to create. And that's, all of us have to fight that. And so you've heard the term that pastors will use that, you know, our sin natures are idol factories. That's true. But then people don't know how to go after that. They don't know how to go digging for that. Well, how do I get that out of me if that's the case? Well, okay, so let's look at this. Let's look at the golden calf and understand it from a spiritual, psychological, mental, emotional, five senses standpoint. This is after they've seen Yahweh work. This is after they've seen the Red Sea split. This is after the 10 plagues. This is, they've seen it all. I don't know how much more display of power you can actually see demonstrated in front of you. And then this is where you turn immediately once Moses is gone for about 40 days. And you can't restrain yourself for 40 days to wait for Moses to get back down. And this is what you do. Aaron buckles under the pressure, and they all, most of them do this. Okay, so what is this about? Why? And you have to answer this question, because if you don't answer this question, you don't know how to answer it for yourself. Why create this when you already saw the display of the one true God's power? And you actually saw it. You saw the Shekinah. You saw the glory cloud. You saw the pillar of fire. You saw the everything. Why would you do this? Within 40 days, you're doing this in 40 days, okay? So you have to think on that front. What are they doing? What is a calf? Why a calf? Or bull, whatever you want to call it. So it's an animal. So what is an animal? It's part of creation, okay? So an animal is part of creation. So all of a sudden, I'm gonna take a piece of creation and exalt it to a position that only is reserved for the invisible God. So I'm gonna take a piece of creation and I'm gonna put it in the exalted place of God, okay? Understand this, that exalted place in your soul that only God sits on. Okay, go back to Exodus. Where did God place himself? In the camp with them at the beginning? No, where does he place himself? On the top of the mountain, okay? So there's a hierarchy that's being established. I'm above you. I come down to you, but I am not part of creation, okay? I'm coming down. Your whole life is ordered up vertically. Your life is vertically upright with me. That's how you order your life. If you take from below the creation and you exalt it to the improper position that only I hold, your whole life will then be ordered by whatever you put in that spot. So if you decide to put creation in that spot that only I can occupy, you will align your life that way according to creation. But creation is inanimate. It cannot do anything, okay? So since it's part of creation and it's inanimate, then why would I as a human take a inanimate object and place it where the only invisible God can sit because I desire what to do with this creation? The creation can't do anything. The one true God can do all because he's omnipotent. He designs reality. He constructs reality. He tells us what reality is in that position. So when I take a piece of creation and I put it in that position, that inanimate object cannot do anything. But who can? I can. So I put the piece of creation in the exalted position. And I know good and well it can't do anything. It can't make me obey. It can't make me do anything. So therefore, I have full control over the piece of creation I have put in the exalted position, and I can shape it to what I want to shape it as. Does that make sense? Okay, so you take that which you can shape and put it in the exalted position, and you put it on the top of Mount Horeb or Sinai. And that becomes how you order your life according to that shape. But that's funny. How are you going to order your life to something that can't give you order? How do you order yourself to something that can't, the golden calf can't give you order. So where are you going to get your order from? Yourself. So the core of idolatry is the exaltation of self into a God that I can shape and form and fashion that would give me the order that I want. That's at the heart of idolatry. If you do not understand that, you're never going to corral the sin nature, because the sin nature works on that principle of taking that which is created and exalting it and ordering your life according to that. That's why people can't get out of idolatry. So the issue then is you take that which should be sacrificed and you exalt it. The calf is supposed to be sacrificed to Yahweh, but they're taking that which should be sacrificed and putting it in the exalted position. So that's what the core of idolatry is. I am taking that which should be sacrificed and putting it in God's position. For what? Right? Because I get something. So you when you take something that should be sacrificed to God and instead make it a god, you'll become a slave to it. Okay? And you're going to make sacrifices. So basically when you're going to find restraint, restraint is found in who and what you worship. That's how you find restraint. So when Paul says, you got to restrain the sin nature, well, it's based on who you worship. So if you can't restrain the sin nature, it's because you have an idol. And you created that idol. And that idol is what's fueling the behavior that you can't restrain. So what do you mean? Well, whatever God you serve, whatever God you make as an idol, you're going to make sacrifices to that God. Because it's in the heart of you to do that. It's in the heart of you to worship. It's in the heart of you to sacrifice. It's like ingrained in human nature. You want to worship, you want to sacrifice. Okay. But if I make my own God, I'm going to worship that God. I'm going to make sacrifices to that God because I'm going to sacrifice because I want what that God gives me. So I form and fashion a type of God that will give me what I want. So I'll make sacrifices to it. So when they make the golden calf, what do they want? What do they want by creating a golden calf? They want a God that's tangible, that they can see and touch with the five senses. That's not something. So when you have a piece of creation that's in the place of God, it doesn't require faith because it's tangible. So the golden calf exhibits that they don't want to operate on faith. Because if you put God into place, you have to operate in faith because you don't see him and you have to trust him. But you put a golden calf, you don't have to trust a golden calf because it's tangible. It's right in front of you. Let the calf lead us. Remember they said that? Let the calf lead us. Let it lead us. How is it going to lead you? It's only going to lead from behind because you're the one pushing it in the lead. So at the end of the day, you can see they want a God that does that can free them from their oppressor, but a God that doesn't make any demands on them. So they would rather, you know, obviously be out of Egypt, but they do not want to go back under another master. They want to have a free-for-all. That's what's going on and why they departed in 40 days with Aaron and saying, we're going to worship a golden calf. Because look, man, you're going up to the mountain to tell me that you're going to bring back the law of God. We don't want that. We definitely appreciate being let go out of Egypt. That's awesome. But that's as far as we want to go. I do not want to be told what to do by this particular God. So a lot of people, you can think about in their life, they want to be rescued by Jesus, but they don't want to obey him. They want him to rescue them from whatever addictions or situations they're in or messes that they have created, and they want the rescue, but then maybe God does rescue them, but they still don't want to obey him. So they're just like the children of Israel. I want rescue, but I don't want to obey. So they created a God that would rescue them, take them to the promised land without any obedience whatsoever. So how in the world can you go to the promised land without obedience? See, that's what they want. They want heaven on earth without obedience. They want the promised land, the milk and honey, without obedience, without responsibility, without anything. So they're rejecting, you know, the stipulations that you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't have it all your way. You have to obey if you want the good things out of life. If you're going to go to the promised land. So that's what they do. And so what ends up happening is people create a God out of creation that allows them to do what they want to do. And if it allows them to do what they want to do, they will make the appropriate sacrifices at the altar of this God. That's how it works. And it could be anything, you know. It could be hedonism, you know, the desire for pleasure or, you know, pleasure principle or whatever. I don't want to feel any pain in this life, okay? So if I don't want to feel any pain in my life, what kind of sacrifices will I make? Not much sacrifices, but I will sacrifice, though. So a hedonist will sacrifice, but what do they sacrifice? If I live purely for pleasure, what am I sacrificing? I'm sacrificing who I am, my person, my identity, because if I live for pleasure, then I give up my character, I give up my reputation, I give up my responsibility. No one's going to respect me. They're going to look at me as some glutton that's out of control. But yet I still get a payoff. So I'm willing to sacrifice my reputation. I'm willing to sacrifice my own life for pure pleasure. I'm willing to sacrifice my relationships for pure pleasure because I don't really care if it burns you that I'm a hedonist. I don't care if you don't want to be around me because I like the pleasure better than I like the relationship with you. Or money. So that's real easy, right? We see people sacrificing for money. They think it's okay to put God, the money as their God. They say, well, I got to make a living. Yeah, it's more than making a living, dude. When you sacrifice to the God of money, you'll do all kinds of stuff. You sacrifice your family, you sacrifice yourself, you sacrifice your health, you sacrifice everything for that, right? Relationships, you don't care as long as you get the money, right? Or power. Power is everything. You see the politicians, right? Influence. Escape is a big thing. So a lot of people say, well, I'm not after power, money, or influence, but I sure like the escape. Yeah, a lot of people like the escape. That's why they do things. And so, you know, if you're looking for escape, think about the things you would sacrifice. Well, I'll sacrifice relationships as long as I can escape. I'll sacrifice my health, whatever. It's just you start realizing that they're still making sacrifices. They're inappropriate sacrifices. They're not proper sacrifices, but they are making sacrifices to get this thing that they want, right? Okay, so when you start having this desire, then that's coming from the sin nature. So the sin nature has a desire, and it's always the opposite of what God desires. And so if that's not constrained, that desire that's taken into idolatry, creating a God, and then you'll sacrifice and worship to that God. And that will somehow get you punished by God or disqualified for this crown. So then you have to go even deeper then. Okay, so if I'm an idol factory and these are the kinds of idols I create, I take creation and I make it a God, then I have to get to the root of where the desire is. Where are my desires coming from? And this is where you have to be brutally honest with yourself, because if you're not, you're never going to find your idol. You'll only get hints of it. So you have to come down to where am I getting these crazy desires inside of me to escape, for power, for money, or whatever. Well, okay, there's several things you have to list here. Well, one is your own sin nature. So you have to take that into consideration, that there's an animal inside of you, a beast inside of you that comes straight from hell that really wants to take you to hell. That's your own sin nature. You're born with it. And it's your job to master it. Now you have a new nature in you too from Christ if you're a believer. So you have both natures, but you still have to contend with that creature inside of you. And that creature is pretty capable of doing some pretty bad things, aren't they? Because if you're honest with yourself and you look at history and what people did in history, and people took delight in hurting other people and hurting themselves and doing really, really nasty things, and you're fooling yourself if you think you look at those people in history like the Germans and say, I would never do that. You're fooling yourself if you think that. Statistically wise, you would be right with them. Statistically wise. Now, everyone likes to think I wouldn't do it. Oh, everyone wants to think in Germany in 1939, I would never, never say the Jews are the problem. I wouldn't say that. Yeah, but 80% of them did. How do you account for that? Again, it's the sin nature. That's the element that most people that study history won't go there, because that sin nature can take delight in a Jew going back and forth across the camp, carrying a wet bag of salt back and forth, meaningless until that Jew dies of exhaustion, and them taking much delight watching the Jew go back and forth from each side of the camp with wet salt, going back and forth until that Jew finally collapses and dies. And then they put another one in there, let him go back and forth until they die, and taking delight in that and not having any qualms. Oh, I would never do that. You're not in touch with your own sin nature. You're very capable of doing the worst horrific things, and you have to admit that. And it's only by God's grace and his new nature and his constraint on you that holds anyone back really from doing the most horrific things. And until you're willing to look at yourself honestly and see what you're actually capable of, then you won't know the depths of why you need Jesus so bad. Because if you don't think you're that bad, then why do you need Jesus? Well, he's gonna save me from some of the little punctiliar sins and trivial sins that I committed, but I'm not really a bad guy. Oh no, that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says you are a bad guy, but you're worth rescuing because you're made in his image. But you have to be honest with yourself. Now, when you're honest with yourself, what you're going to see develop inside of you is where all this junk is coming from. And it's shame, it's guilt, it's narcissism, degrees of narcissism, or whatever you want to call it. But all of us will carry around shame and guilt now in our sin nature. Why is that? Because when Adam and Eve sinned, what did they do? Ran and hide and made fig leaves. So that's guilt and shame. So you're not any different than Adam and Eve. I'm not any different from Adam and Eve. So the sin nature is going to shame me, and the sin nature is going to guilt me. And the sin nature is going to create an ultimate narcissist, right? And the narcissism is starting to brew up in Adam when God says, what's happened, and what does he do? It's the woman you gave me. What? That's classic narcissism, isn't it? I'm going to blame someone else. So the narcissism is already developing in Adam. So again, we're not talking like a full-blown diagnostic, you know, narcissist, and there are those, and there's really no cure for them. But we all have degrees of narcissism because that's what the sin nature wants us to do. It wants us to love ourselves too much. And so those are the three biggies. And so you have to contend with that. Is my shame and my guilt or my narcissism creating an idol in my life? You have to come to terms with that. Well, how would I know that? Well, look at your behavior and work backwards. Well, how would I know if I'm a narcissist? How would I know if I have shades of narcissism? Well, it has to do with, what are you constantly thinking about all day long? If you're thinking about yourself all day long, that's a good sign. Right? I mean, you should be thinking about others, and you should be thinking about work, and you should be thinking about how am I going to do this, or how am I going to do it. But if you're sitting there, I wonder how I look, I wonder how I'm dressed, I wonder how this is going to appear. I mean, dude, you're like a narcissist. Enough. Like, you have to corral that. And so the idol is yourself. You've put yourself in the spot. You know, that's what narcissism does. It puts himself in the God spot. Shame. So then let's talk about how that drives a person. So people feel shameful what they did in their past, okay? Adam and Eve sin, they hide and they make fig leaves. So they hide and they front. So shame will make you hide and front. And so the idol will be your front. That's your idol. The idol will be your persona that you project to people that you want them to know. But you don't want them to know the real shameful person that you're hiding fine. So your front becomes the fig leaf and that front becomes your idol. So you use that as your idol. So you will make sacrifices to that front. How will you do that? Through performance. That's how you'll do it. And guilt's kind of the same thing. You'll create a false persona. Now, how about your history? Your history, you have to look at your history, and your history will tell you things. Were you betrayed? Were you abandoned? Did you have infidelity practiced against you? Do you have PTSD? Did you suffer any abuse as a child, sexual or physical or whatever? Did you have these? If you had them, then you need to consider it, because most people think, oh, well, I had those, but I thought I was over that. And it's not like that. It's not that you can even push that aside. You have to contend with that. You have to deal with that, because that will create an idol. Well, what do you mean? Well, let's say you were betrayed, okay? You felt betrayed, and maybe you really were, or maybe it's perceived, but you feel betrayed. So the desire inside of you is, I will never be betrayed again. That's the desire. That's what's creating the desire. But that desire will create an idol. So guess what kind of idol it'll create? If I have a desire that I will never be betrayed, I'll create the idol of distrust of everybody. And so I distrust everybody, that's my God, and I will order my life according to that distrust, which means I become detached emotionally to everyone. I am not going to connect, because if I connect, I'm gonna be betrayed and I don't wanna get hurt again, so I will keep people at a distance and not connect to them emotionally. And so, because I have an idol of betrayal in front of me. But here's the thing. Like I said, you put anything in creation on that pedestal where God goes, and the rest of your life is ordered by that. You cannot serve two masters, okay? You can't say, well, I'm a Christian serving Jesus, but then bow a knee every night to your master of betrayal, because you will orient your life according to that idol. And you and some people try to straddle both fences, but it ends up not working at the end. You're either going to love the one and hate the other, and I can already guarantee where you're going to go. And I can guarantee where I will go. It will go towards this idol thing. How about pain? You have pain in your life. Most people have pain, abandonment issues, rejection. Rejection's a typical pain issue that everyone's dealing with. So, okay, if I have pain and rejection, and that's my desire, is I will never be rejected again. So what do I do? Again, I will make an idol. And maybe it's performance. Maybe it's maybe I will act it out or whatever. I don't know. Or maybe the pain is so bad then my idol becomes an addiction, and I hide behind the addiction to kill the pain inside of me. So the addiction is my God, and I'm hiding behind that. Whatever, you know, and you can see that in a lot of people's lives, that they're trying to kill the pain. So you tell them that you have to stop doing this, and they're not about to, because what am I going to do to kill the pain, right? So you have that. The other thing you can look at is trauma. Trauma causes a lot of things. It causes codependencies issues, causes gaslighting. Were you gaslighted? You know, did you experience grief? Well, if you experienced grief, did you grieve? Most people haven't grieved in their lives. They went through the process of someone dying or the process of losing something, but they actually never grieved. But you know how you know it? Because in grief, that's God's gift to you in order to express what's in you, to get it out of you. But if people arrest that grief and they start bargaining, or they go into depression, or they get angry, they get stuck in grief and they never get out of it. And so it just simmers there. And after a while, you let it simmer for a long time, it starts sprouting branches all over the place, and you have weird idiosyncrasies in your behavior that you seem to not be able to control anymore. Your emotions are out of whack, your thinking's out of whack, your physical body's out of whack. You start getting sick. You know people that are sick all the time? Do you? Take a second guess next time about whether or not it's a real sickness. I'm not saying it's not, but whether that's generated from their thinking. Because a lot of people, their thinking messes them up and actually makes them sick. It's actually a protective mechanism sometimes psychologically to be sick, because you get attention when you're sick. And people that don't have attention when they're young, they want attention when they're older, so they're always sick. I knew a lady in my previous ministry. Every time I turned around, she was sick in the hospital. Every time I turned around. I mean, I went to the hospital more than ever to go see her, and so did all the other pastors that went and visited her. And it was like, dude, there wasn't, I don't know, 40 weeks out of 52, she wasn't in the hospital or sick or some down on something, whatever. She finally died. I don't know if that, you know, and not trying to be mean or anything, but I think, you know, but what happened? Well, I could tell. I would tell my other associates, my pastoral associates, and I was just a young guy at the time. I said, look, I don't know if I'm right or not, but I every time I go in there and visit her, like, she's all pumped up out of her mind when we go visit her. Instead of lamenting that, you know, here I am again for the 40th week in a row. And I said, you think she likes the attention? And he goes, well, you know, why do you ask questions you already know the answer to? I said, that's pretty sick. I said, that's my theory. He goes, well, I don't think you're wrong. It seems to me that she does like the attention. I said, is it possible that someone would make themselves sick to get attention? He goes, oh yeah. Oh, thank you. It's amazing what the human mind will do when you create an idol. So you want the idol of attention? You actually, there's people that will make themselves sick to get attention. It's called Munchausen. And then if they want other people sick, and they want the attention, it's called Munchausen by proxy. Right? They got labels for this stuff, right? But what drives that? What drives that is I want attention, and I will get the attention any way I possibly can. And if it worked at home when I was growing up, you know, mom and dad would give me attention. That was the only way I got attention. Then the idol becomes attention getting, and I'll make myself sick. Ooh. You think, Brandon, no one goes to that depth. Yeah, they do. Oh, yes, they do. They do weird stuff, guys. And that's why I'm saying, like, if you're not in touch with your sin nature and how the depths it can go, you won't be able to arrest any idolatry inside yourself. You have to really admit that, hey, man, I can really twist things up pretty quick. And I got to be honest with myself. I mean, you could say, well, you know, I'm seeing signs of codependency in me. Yeah, it's probably true. We all have a little bit in us, right? We all have a need to be needed, don't we? Oh yeah, if you don't corral the need to be needed, guess what you'll turn into? A full-blown codependent. Because what is a codependent looking for? To use the psychological term, what do they need? They want people to need them. Right? So they derive value off being needed. Okay? So if you tell them you're not needed, they don't have any value. But yet the Bible says that you have value because you're made in the image of God. You're that valuable, right? That Christ would die for you. But a codependent doesn't think like that. A codependent says, I only get value if I'm needed. So guess what codependents do? They pick the worst projects of people you could possibly imagine and try to fix them, right? And these projects that they pick are like way above their pay grade, right? These people, you need professional help. You're not gonna solve their problems. But the little bit of narcissism in them and then the little bit of codependency that's working together says, I can fix them. I can make it work. And if they had this and they had that and I provide this, it'll work. And then what happens? It's a failed project to begin with. And they try it and it fails and they move on to the next person that needs them. But that's what drives them. So the idol then that gets created is a need to be needed. That's the idol. So we all need that, but then you have to put that in biblical terms. And how do I satisfy that? Well, you are needed by God. That's why he sent his son. He wants you to be with him. So there's your need. That's how it's met, by God. But if you don't accept that, you'll go for, codependency. Family, obviously, if you grew up in a family that had bad boundaries or maybe no boundaries whatsoever, like no consequences or whatever for bad behavior, if they had weird standards that you had to keep as a kid, if there was favoritism going on in your family, that's going to create an idol, guaranteed, because you'll try to live up to the person that didn't give you the favoritism, and you'll try to live up to according to their standard, and guess who will be your God? The one who didn't give you the favoritism. And you will try to live your life according to the one who didn't give you the favoritism, which is insane, right? Insane, because God says, look, you can't keep the standard. I'm gonna send my son to keep the standard. You will trust in him, and that's how you're gonna be accepted. But how do you get acceptance from a human being that you never could get acceptance, and now they're dead? What are you gonna do, keep playing the game? What are you gonna do? Just keep just doing insanity, right? I'm gonna keep that person on the pedestal to try to satisfy them, even the ghost of them, and they're not here, and I'm gonna let that drive my whole life? Man, that's it. That's the golden calf. That's the golden calf, right? Or then you bring in Satan and forget that, man. This dude, like, he's after you, right? So he comes at you with lies. He'll try to create a performance individual out of you. He'll get you into wrong thinking. And the quickest way to idols is through Satan. There's no doubt about that. If you let him speak lies to you, the lies will create idols. No doubt about that. And then you got the world system. And the world system comes in different flavors, but typically it's through fear. People get afraid of not fitting in, they get afraid of being called names. They want to be people pleasers and that kind of thing. If that's you and you have the idol of people pleasing, you will never stand up for yourself. You will never stand up for the truth because you want to make everyone happy. Look, man, as a Christian, you got to realize, man, the majority of this population, you're not going to make happy at all. They hate what you say. And if you can bear that, good for you. You know what that's called? Freedom. So you mean I can tell the truth and get to the point where I don't care what people think? Yeah, if you can get to that point, dude, you're free. You are really free. But if you're playing the game, I'm afraid to say something because they won't like me or they'll call me a name. Dude, Satan, the world system's got you. But what is that idol? I want to be liked. The idol of I want to be liked. And where would that come from? Well, maybe from the world system. Maybe from your upbringing. I don't know. Maybe you were the last person that was ever picked on any team when the kids divided, right? Maybe that was your problem. And, you're kicking the ground saying, they never picked me. Yeah, I want to fit in. And so now you have this complex that you got from junior high because no one picks you. And so now you go into life and you're like, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that girl that's never picked and says that's a loser. And I don't want to be a loser. So I want to fit in and I want to get along with the gang. And so what ends up happening as an adult, you play the game at work like that. You play the game in society like that, or you play the game in the family. And all it comes back to is you weren't picked. You were picked last on the junior high soccer team or something like that. And you're like, wow, that could affect me. Yeah, it could totally affect you because it's whatever you perceived in your life. Well, I was kind of a nerdy guy, or I was this, or I was that, and no one really liked me. I was homely until, I reached a different age or whatever. And so, I was gangly or whatever the issue is, right? But what happened? It was rejection for whatever, and I want to be part of the group, and I was expelled out of the group. I will never be expelled again. And so that person loses all power to tell the truth because they want to fit in. They want to fit in. So it's dangerous, as you can see. So taking that which is part of creation, exalting it. Now, remember what I said. They make a golden calf. So when the judgment comes in all of this, right, what does God make them do? Well, they're going to destroy the calf, right? Right? 3,000 of them die. So they killed 3,000. So you have early death, okay? Early death. They're penalized physically. So don't think they're not saved. It's just early death because of this. Because any believer can get into idolatry. If we were all killed for idolatry, we'd all be dead. Because it's we do create these things. But the funny thing is, it's weird. You ever thought about what Moses made them do? So he destroyed this, and he ground it up and powdered. And then what did he do? He made them drink it in the water. That's weird. Why would he make them drink the very thing they worshiped? That's weird. Because if the answer to that is the answer of how he's going to deal with it with you. I'm going to ground it into fine powder. I'm going to throw it in the water and I'm going to have them drink it. So they consume the very thing they worshiped, goes in them, and then it would be expelled out of them. Okay? But once it's expelled, because they had to swallow gold. Okay? Once it's expelled, you can't use that gold anymore. Because the gold's going to come out of them. Right? The gold's going to come out of them. They're going to swallow the gold, and it's going to come out of them. But they can't use the gold anymore. Why? Because now it's contaminated. It's polluted. They can't use it anymore for anything anymore. Huh, I wonder what that is a sign of. I'm going to eat the very thing I worship so I can't ever use it again. Are you catching on a little bit? I can't ever use the gold again. That way they can never create another idol out of that gold. Now they can create other idols, but they're not going to use that gold again to create another idol. Huh. So it seems to be, in this type of judgment, that when we do create idols and we're finally going to be judged for it or whatever, and God's going to exterminate it out of our lives, that he will pulverize it, which means he will basically take it away. He will destroy it when he doesn't like it. And then he's going to make us metabolize it. He's going to make us eat it. And eating it actually creates, it's the metabolism factor of taking it and digesting it and it going through their whole system and then expelling it. So you're actually going to eat it as a part of judgment. You're going to metabolize this. It's going to become part of you. And then whatever's left, you're never going to use again because I'll fully destroy it out of your life and you'll never be the same anymore after it's done. So it seems to me that God takes idolatry pretty seriously to me. So the idea is then when you do find your idol and he does expose it to you and he's going to destroy it out of you, then he will make you metabolize it. And that means he will burn it into your soul like you have never felt it before. You will metabolize it and it becomes part of you because he's going to use that to say, that will never happen again. You will never go back to that again. So I want you to never forget what you did. I don't want this being repeated because sin is serious to me and other gods are serious to me. And I am going to make you never forget what you did. And then at the end of this, I will cut you off from the access of ever using that again. You will never be able to pick it up and do it again. Guaranteed. Once it's exterminated out of your body, you're never going to touch it again. And so that's the way he judges an idol. It becomes part of you. You metabolize it so that you'll never forget it. And then you can't use it again if you get to that process. That's if you don't die first with an idol. Because an idol can kill you, can't it? An idol can kill you. You take drugs as an idol, you're going to die at some point. I was just talking to my neighbor the other day, and I said, hey, where's that kid go? And he goes, yeah, he died. He overdosed. And I said, really? I didn't even know that. And I said, yeah. I go, well, he was doing meth all his whole life. And so he finally died, apparently overdosed. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Like, so you hope that you can get the idol out of you before it kills you, right? And it killed that poor kid who was using meth his whole life, basically. And so that's what I'm talking about. An idol can kill you, right? That's no joke. We see that all the time, or money could kill people. It gives them hypertension and they die of a heart attack or something like that, right? They can't take it. Or anger. They can't control their anger. And eventually their anger kills them or kills someone else, right? So if you're going to corral the sin nature, you got to start with your idol. And then you got to go backwards and then work with the desire and figure out where that desire is coming from. And then once you figure out where the desire is coming from, then you have to bombard that with the truth. And the truth then sets you free. The truth will get you aligned back up into putting God in the proper place of your life. And then you can order your life according to him being in the proper place. If he's not in the proper place, you have an idol. And it's going to align. You're going to align differently, okay? So I hope that makes sense. I hope that's clear as mud, but that's how you get to it, okay?
Thanks for joining us for another lesson. We hope that this message is a blessing for you and helps you grow towards a more mature understanding of God's Word. For more information about our ministry, we invite you to check out our website at rockharborchurch.net. Until next time, remember, keep looking up, for our redemption draws near.